It's Thursday, March 4th. I'm Oscar Ramirez in Los Angeles, and this is The Daily Dive. The rise of doorbell cameras have become a powerful tool for law enforcement, but they also pose a risk. The same cameras can be used against them by allowing suspects to see cops coming, possibly causing harm to them. It happened in South Florida when two FBI agents were killed by a suspect who saw them coming on their Ring doorbell cam. Privacy issues also arise as millions of people are being recorded without their knowledge or consent. Drew Harwell, technology reporter at The Washington Post, joins us for more. Next, scientists have been talking to people in their sleep, and they're answering back. Researchers have been able to establish two-way communication with people while they were in a lucid dreaming state. Participants in the study were asked math questions and responded back with eye movements and facial expressions. Researchers hope that one day, some sort of dream therapy could be possible in helping people out. Karen Conkley, PhD student at Northwestern University and one of the researchers on the project, joins us for How It All Works. It's news without the noise. Let's dive in.
FBI agents were going to execute a search warrant on this guy. The guy was able to see them through his home camera, and he opened fire through the door. And it's a horrible incident, and it just goes to show that, you know, these cameras, they really allow the owner to have a lot more power and a lot more sort of monitoring ability that we've never really had to reckon with before.
Joining us now is Drew Harwell, technology reporter at The Washington Post. Thanks for joining us, Drew.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We've had you on a couple times to talk about Ring door cams. And right now you have the latest story about, obviously, this has become a real big asset for law enforcement across the country, but it's also becoming a big risk for them. Just most recently in the news, we heard about the singer Lady Gaga's French Bulldogs being stolen. We got some really clear audio and video from that from a Ring doorbell camera. But on the flip side of this, police are concerned also. There was an FBI raid going on at someone's house, and the people that they were going to their house, they were able to see the FBI agents coming on these Ring doorbell cameras. I think two FBI agents ended up getting shot there. So this kind of give and take with these Ring doorbell cams. So Drew, tell us a little bit more about what we're seeing.
It's the gift and the curse of omnipresent surveillance. And cops, police are getting a ton of evidence and material that they otherwise never would have seen because there are millions of these cameras now out recording all the time, saving video of just, you know, random sidewalks and doorsteps that never would have been caught on camera. So, you know, I've talked to police officers and they've said, like, all of these cases of cars getting broken into or vandalism, we never would have had evidence before. We now have evidence. That's great. But the flip side is that, you know, and the FBI and local law enforcement have talked about this as a risk in terms of, we don't even know who's watching us when we go to the door. If we're executing a search warrant or just knocking on the door to ask somebody, you know, if I'm a first responder going to a medical call, attending to some domestic violence or something, I don't know who's going to be watching me from the other side, what they're doing, if they're going to try and do me harm. And so that's, you know, exactly what we saw in the case in South Florida, where FBI agents were going to execute a search warrant on this guy. The guy was able to see them through his home camera, and he opened fire through the door. And it's a horrible incident. And it just goes to show that, you know, these cameras, they really allow the owner to have a lot more power and a lot more sort of monitoring ability that we've never really had to reckon with before.
It's hard to track exactly how many of these type of doorbell cameras are out there, but, you know, experts say it could be in the millions. And this could be just Ring cameras. There's also Google Nest. There's other doorbell cams that are out there. But tell me about what we know about how many households might have these type of cameras in front of their homes.
We know it's definitely in the millions. Ring has said, you know, they have millions of clients out there. And there are researchers who have done their own kind of analyses, and they say, but there's probably more than 3 million Ring doorbell cameras. And then that's not even including all of the other Ring devices, right? They have stick-up cams that you could put anywhere. They have peephole cameras. They have indoor cameras. They're building new ones. And, you know, Google Nest has their own sort of huge user base. There's Blink and Arlo. There's a bunch of competitors now, and they're all kind of competing, and they're all driving down the prices. They're making them more accessible. and easier to install and buy and use. And so, you know, but it, so it's interesting because a lot of people are turning these on and they're not, you know, tech people. They are, they're people who want the peace of mind. They want to know, okay, I got my shipment at my door. It's not going to get stolen. Or I want to know who's sort of knocking on the door at night or whatever. So, you know, there's a huge kind of peace of mind factor to why these things are so popular. And yet, you know, the other side of it is that all of these residential areas are getting, you know, millions of cameras now overseeing their public areas. And these are areas where, you know, kids play and neighbors meet up and, you know, people are delivering packages, delivering mail, delivering food, knocking on the door and asking for charity. All these people are being recorded and watched in a way that, you know, we weren't really prepared for. And so I'm just sort of interested in how that's changing law enforcement, how that's changing kind of community life now that everything is so closely under surveillance.
Tell me a little bit about the relationship that law enforcement has with Amazon and these Ring doorbells, because they made about 20,000 requests last year for footage captured by these cameras. There's partnerships that they have together in, I think it was almost every state except Montana, I think it was in your article. Tell me a little bit more about that.
A couple years ago, Ring started building a tool that would allow police to, you know, they can draw a map, they can draw sort of a box around an area where there was a crime, and Ring will automatically email out these police requests to people and say, if you have video from, you know, these hours and you want to share it, just, you know, click yes effectively, and the cops will be able to see whatever your system recorded. So that was, you know, back in 2018, that was something that only a couple dozen police forces had online, but now there's more than 2,000 across the U.S. and practically every state, like you said, except Montana and Wyoming, from corner to corner of the country, rural, suburban, urban, every kind of police force now has this kind of access. And so, you know, more than 20,000 requests for video from people last year went out from these agencies. And, you know, the people who own the cameras can say no. They can volunteer their footage or they can refuse and they won't be punished for it. But a lot of homeowners just say, oh yeah, of course not. Why would I not, you know, share my video if I can contribute to stopping a crime or whatnot? And yet it's really interesting because Ring is really the only one who has sort of formalized this relationship with the police. Other companies, including Google Nest, have said, we're not working on any kind of partnership with that. And, you know, privately, there's been some anxiety around how closely should a private company work with, you know, the public authorities, public law enforcement, to convey that kind of, you know, sensitive data and surveillance data over to the police, who's being recorded and what's being captured. And so, you know, Ring has really formalized that in a way, and police have really sort of taken to it. And we're just kind of starting now to understand what the side effects are.
As you mentioned, millions of cameras out there, millions of people being recorded. It can be a great asset for police. But then again, the concern that we've been talking about, the flip side of that, people watching cops as well. And there was numerous FBI bulletins and memos that went out alerting agents to certain things like this. So it's a real concern, as you mentioned, as these things just keep increasing and the surveillance of everybody really keeps increasing.
I have found it interesting that the FBI did put those bulletins out because, you know, on one hand, you can sort of criticize them by saying like, oh, well, so you don't like to be on the other side of the camera, right? I mean, surveillance has been watching people for a long time, but you know, you don't want to be seen doing your job. But I think it just goes to show that there's a power dynamic here and a power imbalance in terms of who's sort of caught on camera and who's actually doing the watching. And when it comes to sort of a city block where you're kind of presuming to be public, you're kind of accepting that, okay, I'm just going to be captured, that's one thing. But the fact that these are so deep into residential areas that people live, they don't necessarily expect to be caught on camera. I just find that fascinating.
Drew Harwell, technology reporter at the Washington Post. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
The French team had that example where the dreamer was at a party and they just heard God talking to them, a voice, you know, from, you know, this disembodied voice. Or in the Netherlands, one example, the dreamer was in the car and it was like they heard it over the radio.
Joining us now is Karen Conkley, PhD student at Northwestern University, and one of the researchers of this study that we're going to talk about two-way communication with dreamers. So, Karen, some really interesting stuff. Researchers, you and your team and teams in other countries were dealing with people that were lucid dreaming, and you were asking them a series of questions, getting responses. I think the questions were very simple, basic things like math questions, but it was just kind of, you know, this little proof of concept that you can speak to dreamers while they're in REM sleep, while they're dreaming, and sometimes they do respond. So, Karen, tell us a little bit more about this study.
We decided to use lucid dreamers because there's a history of lucid dreamers communicating out of dreams that's been studied since about the 80s. So if you're in a dream, it's different than sleep talking because your whole body is paralyzed. And so that's in REM sleep. And so you can't normally move your mouth or anything like that. And so we have to rely on signals that dreamers can still give once they're completely paralyzed that we can monitor from the outside. So dreamers will make series of eye movements like left, right, that stand out dramatically from the natural eye movements that happen in REM sleep. And then, or for instance, dreamers can also twitch. And so like the French team used kind of twitching of the dreamer's facial muscles. And since those signals are pre-arranged in advance, if a dreamer makes those, we can monitor that objectively and say, yes, they're definitely sleeping. And also, they just answered our question. So it was really exciting to see that in action.
You know, for those that might not be very familiar, lucid dreaming is, you know, when you're inside your dream, you realize that you're dreaming and you don't, you know, immediately wake up, obviously. And then a lot of people say sometimes you can go in and control the dream, all that stuff. It's very interesting. So a little more onto the study then. Obviously, you said you got in contact with people that had some experience in this, but how did you get across that we're going to be asking you questions and know that they were going to either understand them? Like, how does that work? Did you have to train them in this?
Each team who was involved in the study, one in the USA, one in Germany, one in France, one in Netherlands, each team conducted the study independently and used different methods to induce lucid dreams and also some different methods to ask questions. About one in two people has one lucid dream at least in their life. And I think about 20% of people are more frequent lucid dreamers and they'll have maybe one lucid dream a month. But we needed in our study people to have lucid dreams while they were in the lab in the next 2 hours or something. So in the US, we trained participants who some had experience with lucid dreaming, others didn't necessarily. And we trained them to have a lucid dream before they fell asleep. So what we did was we associated a sound that sounded just like a beeping noise, beep, 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 with a lucid state of mind while they were awake. So like as you notice the sound, you become lucid, bring your attention to your thoughts, kind of like a meditation. And then we presented the sound again when they were dreaming. And in a original study that we demonstrated this technique, people had lucid dreams half of the time when we did this protocol. Wow. So you know, although it's only half the time, that's pretty good for lucid dreaming studies.
Sure.
So we and the Dutch team used this method again to induce lucid dreams in the lab. And then those participants would tell us that they're lucid dreaming. We'd say like, okay, if you know you're dreaming, look left, right, pretty fast, two times or something. And then we'd see that while they're sleeping and we'd say, okay, this person knows they're in a dream, time to ask a question.
So what were those questions and what kind of answers did you get?
The four teams conducted the studies independently, and yet three of them independently decided we should ask math problems. And the reason for that is it was really because we wanted to ask questions that we knew the answers to, that there would be, you know, a variety of responses for that the dreamers could execute without having to like memorize a whole scheme of responses, you know, yes means this and no means this and maybe means this. So that's why we asked math problems. And we just presented them in, you know, my voice very softly for our team. The German team presented them in Morse code. And then the dreamers heard those problems inside the dream. And then they just answered them like, you know, look left, right twice if the answer is two. And so
can you give me an example of a question, how you asked it? Do the voice as well. That way we can hear it. Because I want to ask something after that as well. But if you can, ask the question briefly.
One of our examples, the dreamer was sleeping and we just asked 8 minus 2, just like that. And then they answered 2 in their dream. And we asked it again. They answered 2 again.
The reason why I asked if you could do it, you know, even in that, in the voice that you did is because some of the people said the question would be, how does a person perceive this in their dream? And some of the respondents said it kind of morphed in their dream, and it seemed as if maybe God was talking to them, you know, some type of grander voice was coming out at them.
So I think that's a really interesting question. You know, you're kind of asking a question from another realm of existence, and like, how does that filter into the dream? So like in the 8-6 example, the participant just seemed to hear it. It just seemed like he just heard it as it was. But in other examples, it gets somehow distorted or incorporated into the dream. So for instance, the French team had that example where the dreamer was at a party and they just heard God talking to them, a voice, you know, from, you know, this disembodied voice. Or in the Netherlands, one example, the dreamer was in the car and it was like they heard it over the radio. And the German example had some, the German team had some great examples where, since they used flashing lights in Morse code, there was one dream where like the lights started flickering in the room and it was Morse code. And then, you know, he found a fish tank and that was flashing in Morse code, and then it broke. So we went outside and the clouds were blinking in Morse code. And so, you know, there's all these interesting ways that the information can get filtered in. And I guess one thing that surprised us is we were worried it would get too filtered. So we were worried we would say like 8-6 and they would hear like 6 and 6 or something that like wasn't answerable. And that actually, you know, it wasn't clear that that happened, you know, very much. The proportion of correct responses was really high, and there wasn't a lot of clear times when it seemed like dreamers heard something that was a really garbled version of what we heard. It seemed like they mostly generally heard what we said, or it was like, or they didn't hear it at all.
All this stuff, you know, dreaming is super interesting all the time, just for a range of different aspects to it. So now that you were able to make contact with people while they were lucid dreaming, you were able to get some responses to varying degrees of success. You know, you have to kind of keep working at this and looking into it. What do we do with this knowledge now? I know you mentioned something about there could be possibilities for dream therapies, things like that. So what do we do with this knowledge?
We were thinking, you know, if a dreamer could give a signal from their dream, you know, I'm struggling with a nightmare, then maybe somebody on the other side could say, like, you know, originally we had an idea that we could just present an alarm, you know, and that two-way interaction could help wake the dreamer up. Or the, you know, more advice could be given to them, more support. You know, it's kind of common to become lucid in a dream and not be able to control it, especially if it's a bad dream. And so, like, if you could have someone on the other side who has that logical advantage of wake, then, like, sometimes you don't have access to all those mental resources in a dream. Even though you're lucid, you're still a little bit confused. Or somebody put it yesterday, sometimes it can be as though you're drunk. Like, it's right. Just like you don't have necessarily all the access to higher functions all the time. And so if you had somebody who's awake on the other end of that saying like, no, remember, it's a dream, and like you can face this monster at, or, you know, try to integrate this experience, then, you know, when people kind of face their nightmare monsters, they can have, you know, their nightmare can stop after that, can be like a powerful experience. Or another one that we thought was that like artists might be able to use it for that same reason. You know, if you're in a dream, you might not be able to, if you don't have two-way communication, you might not be able to transmit, you know, your work or your ideas right away. But if you could, you know, have somebody on the other end, they could help guide you and remind you what you wanted to do. And then you could kind of say, you know, you could start to give some information about, you know, what you're experiencing in the dream. And then there's really interesting scientific applications as well. Like using that, you could kind of say, well, is what people report after, you know, waking up from a dream, how close is that to what they're reporting during the dream? You know, are dream reports accurate, or are they sometimes distorted or forgotten? And like, can we say how often that happens is a kind of a big question in dream research that would be really cool to get some information on.
Obviously, you're one of the researchers on this project. Do you have any experience with lucid dreaming? Have you gone through that whole process?
Yeah, I mean, that's why I wanted to study it. I read a book about it in college. And I started having lucid dreams, and I was like, this is the coolest thing ever. What should I major in? And then I figured out you could study lucid dreaming, and I was like, oh, yeah, I definitely want to do that. So, I mean, it's a lot of effort. I would love to have more lucid dreams, but I definitely, you know, I love the ones that I have, and I try to try out my experiments in them when I can.
Karen Conkley, PhD student at Northwestern University, one of the researchers on this project, two-way communication with dreamers. Thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That's it for today. Join us on social media, @DailyDivePod on both Twitter and Instagram. Leave us a comment, give us a rating, and tell us the stories that you're interested in. Follow us on iHeartRadio or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. This episode of The Daily Dive is produced by Victor Wright and engineered by Tony Sorrentino. I'm Oscar Ramirez, and this was your Daily Dive.